Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
The Bernstein and McKnight Show.
These players are here because of what they bring specifically, both between the lines and in the clubhouse. We feel that they make us better in 2019 and have the potential to have a lasting impact on what we're trying to build for the long term. Not going to get into the relationships they have with other players throughout the game. It's certainly a positive, but I wouldn't say it's by no means a reason to make a move in to acquire either player.
Middays on the Score.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. That is White Sox general manager Rick Hahn talking about the signings of Yonder Alonso and
John Jay,
because saying it just so happens that they're close with Manny Machado.
What are the odds?
Going to make a decision. Here to talk about that and more is a guy you can follow on Twitter at John Morosi of MLB Network and Fox Sports. John, how are you?
Dan, Connor, Happy New Year. Thanks for having me on the show today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. You know, John, I was reading some stuff by baseball writers much smarter than I am, and the phrase "analytics haven't ruined the game, but they have killed the offseason" has come up a couple of times. And I feel like that's more and more true as days go by. I wonder if you buy that sentiment or if we're missing the forest for the trees.
I think there's some truth to that, Connor. I think that you look at the way that that the pace of the offseason has evolved over time, and I think you're right that the analytics are part of it. And that being said, it's not always for the worst. I think you look at the way that the Red Sox had that staring contest with J.D. Martinez last year, which didn't conclude until after spring training began, and things worked out pretty well for J.D., and they worked out pretty well for the Red Sox winning the World Series. So it can work out. Waiting can work out for both parties. It certainly was the case for the Brewers. They signed Lorenzo Cain around this time last year. Actually, I think even later in January. It was, I think, about probably 10 days later than it is right now. They signed Cain, they traded for Yelich on the very same day, and they came within one win of the World Series. So it can work. It can also work in the opposite direction, where you saw pitchers like Lance Lynn, Alex Cobb, they signed late, and they weren't ready. It didn't appear, at least based on the way they pitched for a lot of 2018. So it cuts both ways. I think that the delay is not great for the game because it results in a lot of players feeling uncomfortable as they begin spring training. They've not had a chance to really get used to their new surroundings. Their families are wondering, where are we going for spring training? There's just a lot of human uncertainty around this that is not ideal. But when you have a collection of executives that really buy into a lot of the same thought processes and the same algorithms, you get a little bit of groupthink. And so you have teams evaluating players in a very similar way, and so when you get similar evaluations, you probably get similar valuations, and then that results in players saying, "Wait a minute, I'm kind of hearing the same thing from a lot of clubs. What does that mean for me? What should I do?" And I think there's just a lot of that paralysis by analysis on all sides, and I think you have this stalemate that you've seen the last couple off seasons.
So, John, is that groupthink, in your opinion, which leads to players waiting and maybe not getting paid what they thought they'd be getting paid, is that groupthink good for the White Sox in their pursuit of Manny Machado or bad?
I think it's good. And it's good in general if you're a team that is willing to make a bold move. I think that, for lack of a better term, boldness is now the new inefficiency. So for a long time, it was on-base percentage or other. Now it's spin rate or pitch framing by catchers. I think, in general, boldness is a rare trait right now in the game. And if you're a team that's willing to be bold, you can really make some pretty dramatic improvements to your roster. And the White Sox are that. And I think that they're not going to be reckless, but they're going to be consistently aggressive. And as methodical as they were in beginning the rebuild when they traded Quintana, eventually, they waited, of course, a while before they traded him. They traded Sale and Eaton first, but even then, it was several months after Rick Hahn made the determination to really reposition the organization. So they're going to be methodical about this. They're not going to be hasty about it, but they're going to be consistently aggressive because you look at where their payroll is right now and where it's been in the past, and they're one of the rare teams that has a really big gap. The Phillies, of course, are another one that have a very big gap between where their payroll is now and where it's been in the past, so they can spend up to that gap, if not even higher than that. So there's a lot to like about the White Sox, and if I were a person, I'd buy stock in them because I think they're going to be able to make some aggressive moves that other teams are going to shy away from. And so I think that helps. It's probably gotten them, unless there's a team that I don't know about, it's gotten them into the final three for Machado, and I think they're in a pretty good spot to get them. They've done everything. If I'm a White Sox fan, they have done everything that I could have asked them to do to this point in time in the offseason to help improve our chances of getting a superstar player to really hang our hat on as an organization. I think it's great for the team. It's great for their fans. Obviously, it's I'm sure dominated. It's been the dominant baseball story in your town this wintertime, which is a rarity, I think, probably for the White Sox. So it's a great storyline for the White Sox, and I think that they're doing things the right way as they pursue it.
Are the Phillies the only team that seem genuinely in on either or Harper or Machado at this point? Because I can't make a sense of where the Yankees are in reality as far as perception.
I think that the Yankees are not really aggressively pursuing Harper. And I think that they are they're open-minded to adding Machado, but by no means are they as aggressive as probably the Phillies or the White Sox are on him. I was told as recently as a couple days ago that the Yankees still have not even made an on-paper formal offer to Machado, which is a little surprising, but that's where they're at. They've got a really good team, and I think that's part of the American League right now is you've got a number of teams that are elite and already really good, and so their desire and requirement to spend a bunch more money to get a little bit better just isn't there in many cases. I think that's where the Phillies and the White Sox both, there's a big narrative behind why they would want one of the superstar players, either Harper or Machado. And I think that for that reason, that emotional reason, which I think is still a very legitimate reason, you can really write the reason for why you would want to make that move. I think in general, and I mentioned the Red Sox earlier, this notion of boldness being a new inefficiency, I think it's a real thing. I really do. The Red Sox, they spent a bunch of prospects to bring in Sale. They spent a bunch of prospects to bring in Kimbrel. They spent a bunch of money to sign David Price. And then another nine-figure deal for J.D. Martinez. And they won the World Series. Now, not every team can do that because part of the reason why it worked for them is they had relatively low-cost, great young players like Betts and Bogarts and Benintendi. That's the core of their club. But for a lot of teams, I think a lot of fan bases now are conditioned to cheer for small incremental wins that look like efficient decisions. When in fact, let's not lose sight of what we do at the end. We don't award the trophy for the best wins above replacement or the best tactical use of arbitration dollars. They still have a trophy for the World Series champion. So let's not forget about what's going on here and the notion of winning and to do that, I still believe you need superstar caliber players, and I think that's what the Phillies and the White Sox are trying to pursue and secure right now.
Talking with John Morosi of MLB Network and Fox Sports on the Bernstein and McKnight Show on The Score, I want to broaden this idea about the way teams are being run, both in the boardroom and in the dugout, and what best practices are understood, and how disconnected it is from what fans of the sport and fans of the game want. Because the game itself is static, it's long, it's drawn out, it has become more difficult to watch. Even diehard fans understand that we are watching strikeouts and walks and a lot of dead time because that's how you win. That is how you maximize the opportunity to scoring runs. Pitching velocity has changed everything. Bullpenning has changed everything. And even from a business perspective, the reliance on advanced media and the revenue streams, the revenue sharing, the way that national television dollars are shared, doesn't necessarily incentivize getting fans to the park, because you don't necessarily need fans at the park anymore. How long can the disconnect continue between the business of baseball, the style of baseball, and actually creating something that the fans want to consume?
Well, it's a great question, and it's one that really is weighing heavily on everybody that's involved in the game, the stakeholders at MLB, the MLBPA, the broadcast partners, fans, corporate sponsors, everybody. I think everybody's concerned about the pace of play and the action on the field. The way I'd answer it is that everybody's responsible for that. I think that MLB has tried to do what they can around the margins to limit the mound visits and other things in game to speed things up, the no pitch intentional walks. So I think that you've got to give MLB some credit for being on board with some of those changes. And the players union, they've incrementally been comfortable with some changes, although not the big ones like the pitch clock. And then there's the whole fundamental change of would you, I know Theo Epstein's talked about this before, limiting relief pitching changes. There's the extreme of starting a runner on second base in extra innings, which mm-hmm. is a low minor league thought process to do that, and it kind of speed games up at the low minors. The more dramatic fixes, I'm not sure that we need them right now or that they're entirely appropriate. I'm talking about like the runner on second base in extra innings, that sort of idea. Mm-hmm. I don't think we need that right now. But I do think there has to be a broader sense of collaboration among the MLB and the MLBPA about ways to make the product more fan-friendly. Is that starting every count 1-1 and making the game faster that way? That's something you have to at least think about. That would speed the game up. It would lessen the burden on pitchers because they would have to throw fewer pitches. I personally like that idea. I think it would make the game much more, again, user-friendly, viewer-friendly. The players may not like it. The teams may have some reservations about it, but you have to modernize it. I can't remember who made it. I think Joel Sherman actually made this point on MLB Network recently, that we've seen the other professional leagues, the NHL, NFL, NBA, make pretty substantial changes, and no one really gets up in arms about it in terms of the traditionalists. There are changes, and they move forward. I think baseball, because of its existence as a pastime and its history in our country, there is this reluctance to change too much of the secret sauce that's made it so great for 100 years. I think that we can probably be a little imaginative about this and be open-minded. So it's just a matter of, I think, really getting at these issues and collaborating in a way that we're not so afraid of changing what's made it great for so long, because, candidly, we're going to have to make some modifications because society has changed. The final thing I'll say on this overall topic is this. I've been lucky enough to cover baseball games in Puerto Rico. I was there in Cuba in 2016 when the Rays went there to play the Cuban national team. And it's interesting. At those games, no one ever complains about the game being slow or taking too much time, because the fans themselves are what we in this country would compare to what you would see at a world soccer game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It is that exciting. It's loud. There's noisemakers. There's chanting, passion. It's amazing. And I think that we could all do a great service to our national pastime by seeing the way it's celebrated in different areas around the world, because we talk about the participatory nature of soccer fans now. It's that way for baseball literally everywhere but here.
I know.
And so I think that we can't lose sight of just the magic of our game and maybe just think about ways that we can embrace it in a little bit of a different way.
We need everybody to be Williams Astudillo.
Yep, that's how it starts.
We need everybody to be Adrian Beltre. Everybody to be Fernando Tatis Jr. And for this all to be like
What's
winter ball.
Bat? Right. I've got no problem with that. That's one I saw that last night, by the way, the Dominican Winter League highlight you're talking about, where the bat was flipped. It probably still hasn't come down.
No.
That's fine. There's like no one was injured in that situation. It was just a joyful moment. We should, in my estimation, embrace the organic and joyful moments of baseball and celebrate them even more.
1,000,000,000% with you. Back to the hot stove, which could be hotter, John. You mentioned that boldness for a lot of teams is this new kind of market inefficiency. How much do you think ingenuity in those contracts, specifically with Harper or Machado and maybe some of the other big ticket guys, might come into it? Are we in an era now where it's not just opt-outs, they're not good enough, where escalators, where deferrals, where all that kind of stuff is going to have to happen for these players, given the way that they're all valued kind of the same in terms of wins above replacement?
Well, that's an excellent point, and I think that's correct. We saw Scott Boras coined this new phrase of a swell opt.
I need to kill. That needs to die. Yeah, like, John, I'm done with
talking
that.
Talking to Ken Rosenthal. Yeah, so it's where you can either have the option picked up and it swells, or the player gets to opt out, the swell opt. I think that where it's useful there is, and Scott, I think, is first, you know, he's really prominent in this conversation here, because, and probably Dan Lozano, Manny's agent as well, but they know where the benchmarks are. And the benchmarks were set almost in a different time. So you think about the Stanton deal, yes, and the Pujols deal, other landmark contracts, A-Rod, of course. And Scott and Dan would say, listen, like, these players are young, they're in their primes, they're 26. Look at where revenues of the game are right now, that the game's in a very healthy place. Adjust for inflation, adjust for overall revenues of baseball, and ergo, the dollar value in the contract should be X. And it's this extraordinary number. That's a very logical argument, but to your point, if it doesn't fit with the way that front offices are operating right now, there's only 30 of them, then you're somewhat out of luck. And so the way that you bridge those two worlds of being able to say, well, my player deserves to be the best AAV and per year player in the baseball history, or the best guarantee, there are different ways, again, whether it's a player option or an opt-out, or you potentially have as much of the AAV or the much of the cash up front, where the first couple of years are massive, $40 million a year, then there's an opt-out after that, so that way you can say it's a $40 million annual contract, even though it's really not over the full extension of it. I think that's probably some of the clever math that we're going to see, because even at the beginning of the offseason, there was a report about Harper's offer from the Nationals. Well, we don't know how much money was deferred. We don't know how much money, how many opt-outs there were, if there were any. And those are two monumentally important things in terms of the way the deal actually works. If it's a dollar this year, then everything else is deferred. Well, it's a really fundamentally different circumstance. So I think there's a lot of that going on, a lot of clever accounting going on that will, I think, at the end of the day, allow these agents to stand up and say, listen, my player got the one of these words that ends in EST, largest, biggest, best contracts ever, even though when it actually comes out in the wash, there are going to be some questions about opt-outs and deferrals and a lot of other creative constructs that somehow remain permissible by rule.
John, great stuff. We appreciate you taking the time for us today.
My pleasure. Happy New Year, and look forward to hopefully many trips to Chicago in the season to come. Thanks so much, guys.
That is John Morosi of Fox Sports MLB Network, MLB.com.
I mean, it all starts, I mean, the offseason being locked up the way it is, and because of front offices working with analytics the way they have, it all starts with player valuation and player compensation in the first 6 years of their major league service time. That's not a fair system right now. It's not fair to players. It's much more slanted toward the team side of things. That has to change if you want the rest of it to flow along.
It's got to be collectively bargained. It's not going to. What's the trade-off?
That's the problem. It's not going to. And there was a contract signed, a player signed, just in the last couple of days, that is both nice to see, a good little story for a team that's been plucky and tough to kill, but it is also, in my mind, the canary in the coal mine of what's going on in this baseball offseason. We'll do that. We'll do Manny Machado and the idea of maybe the White Sox being your number one suitor for the best player this offseason. It's Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
There's a lot of misinformation out there. There's been numerous players that we were supposedly in on that we had not had conversations on. There's been reports of offers or non-offers or being in or being out that, under the rules, we're not allowed to respond to. So you just have to let those things play out.
Rick Hahn reminding you that much of what you're hearing is simply pure speculation when it comes to who's where on some of these big names and small names alike. There was what appeared to be a relatively minor signing right there in the Cubs division just a couple of days ago. It actually might be a bigger deal.
Yeah, it felt like it to me. I want to start with the Manny Machado situation here, though. We'll get to a signing in the NL Central in a minute, because I think one sets up the other. Rick Hahn, that sly silver fox just waiting around to snatch up Manny Machado, has a reputation, or had a reputation going in as the GM of the White Sox, as the guy who put the contracts together. Remember how the conversation went around Rick Hahn for a while? It was the Sale deal, and it was the Eaton deal, and the Quintana deal, all those contracts that netted as many prospects back as they did. And in talking about the Machado contract, the one that's rumored to be out there, the $200 million figure, there's been a lot of worry that, oh my God, if the White Sox are at $200 million, which maybe they are, maybe they're not, then they're not serious bidders for Manny Machado. I think you take a look at that figure, you take it with a big grain of salt, because like Rick said in the cut coming back, you don't know. But you probably have to give some benefit of the doubt to an organization that's been as good about getting around the contract fine print as most in baseball.
Okay.
So let's start there. Second is, if that $200 million figure is something that's real, if that's floating around the middle of like reasonable this hot stove season, then it's entirely possible that teams, all of them using analytics and all of them using a valuation on players,
yeah,
they're a lot more similar than anything else.
We have to stop saying all of them using analytics. This is business now. This is just...
It is. But I think a lot of teams, I think a lot of fans haven't come around to that yet. So I think using some of the whiteboard language, some of the remedial stuff, I think that's helpful for a lot of people.
It's just the business of baseball.
So maybe it's possible that some of these guys aren't as valued, or maybe it's possible that the values of these players are able to push down a little bit by a bunch of teams who just don't see the openings for these players, as many openings as some of the agents have. I get to the player that's the canary in the coal mine too for his labor situation in a second.
So let's talk about Yasmani Grandal. It was $18 million plus and a one-year deal.
For a 30-year-old catcher.
A one-year deal with Milwaukee. And even though our lasting images of Grandal were a really bad playoffs.
A complete train wreck.
An actual train wreck.
Running over a teacup.
Yeah, it was where he couldn't catch and couldn't hit.
Also, the throwing suffered.
And couldn't throw.
The running was probably an issue as well. All of the things that make up a baseball player, he struggled with in this postseason. But there the Brewers are again, making a under-the-radar pickup, a sly kind of pickup, to let them, hopefully, keep the window open in an NL Central that's gotten tougher and tougher. That's the kind of signing where Cubs fans look around and go, hey, Wes, hey, somebody. Anything. Let's do something.
Yeah, it's now an anomaly to give money to a good player who might help you win.
Yasmani Grandal has 20 home runs in three consecutive seasons from the catcher position. Jason Stark was tweeting about this. Do you know the other three active catchers with a streak of similar nature, at least 20 home runs from the catcher position? Active players.
Current
active
streak.
Players. No, the streak does not have to be ongoing.
Buster Posey?
No.
No?
No. I know.
Full-time catchers.
Yes, these men are full-time catchers.
JT Realmuto hasn't done it.
Not enough seasons. The constable of baseball police.
Brian McCann
has hit 20 home runs in 9 seasons of consecutive nature. Salvador Perez.
Okay.
And Matt Wieters in 2011 to 2013. Those are the only three catchers that have done the same. That's the kind of air that Grandal is in. Plus, he's a really good framer and a good catcher to boot. He got a one-year deal for $18.25 million. That is just a little bit more than what the qualifying offer would have been. That's something like 17 and change. So put that in perspective, too. You have that good a player with that kind of reputation signing for that kind of money in this offseason. Russell Martin got $82 million for 5 years at age 32. Grandal is 2 years younger, probably a similar hitter, if not just a little bit worse, probably just about as good a catcher, and he's getting $18.25 a year for a one-year deal. Russell Martin gets $16.4 per year for a five-year. That's to the Toronto Blue Jays. We're looking to win for a 32-year-old This environment is getting more and more untenable for labor. It just is.
The fact that he had to take a one-year deal at that age.
And maybe he just wanted to. You know, maybe, I guess the out here is maybe he just wanted to go to a place where maybe you get a chance to win, you fight a little bit, and maybe his reputation was more dinged than we thought given that postseason. I don't think that's true. I think what's more likely is that if you combine some of the numbers that are floating around the big free agents in Machado and Harper, and everybody's kind of sniffing around thinking, boy, that number doesn't seem right. You know, all year long, you and I have been talking about these guys as $30 million a year players.
We were up to $500 million for Bryce Harper at one point.
Not that long ago either. Probably just before this season started.
Everybody seems to be the rich teams. The Cubs are a have. The Cubs are one of the elite, and even they are saying, well, you know, there's a budget. We have a budget.
You can argue that really every team could be a have if they wanted to be a have.
Well, what I'm saying is every team, when I say that, I mean major market, major television deal down the line,
sure.
Ancillary revenue sources.
Sure.
The point is any team can afford Machado or Harper. The
yes.
Padres can afford him. Anybody,
no doubt, the
Marlins, the whatever you think, the Kansas City, the bottom feeders, anybody would have enough money to sign Machado or Harper, and anybody telling you they don't is lying.
Yes,
it's just a matter of the teams that actually have, they're throwing off more cash than some other teams. It just sounds strange for this playbook to be, no, that's too steep a price for us.
I worry about what it feels to me. We talked about with John Morosi that. Because these teams, through this groupthink type stuff, through being smarter, you know, they all see players as the same value. They all see players through the same types of lenses. You know, you want teams have their own proprietary stuff, and they believe that they've got an advantage in some things over others. But when it comes to free agent signings, it's kind of on the wall.
Even if you're not using proprietary stuff, for our purposes, if you just go to what FanGraphs has done to calculate the annual free agent equivalent value of a win.
Right.
I mean, just as a blunt benchmark that tells you what you're supposed to pay someone. It's not an agent coming in and say, hey, let me make my case to you of I got a player for you. You got to see this guy and you need him right now. There's no reason for that anymore. There's no need.
The Orioles changed out their front office. They're not going to be swayed by that anymore.
Right. You know who's available. You know what the value of a win is in a given year, and if you project that guy to be in this range of wins, you have a contract that comes down in that range of wins.
You're headed toward labor unrest. That's where baseball is headed, and it sucks. It just really does. I hope there's some way to avoid that. I don't know. I think maybe two things will be conjoined here. The pace of play stuff or making baseball more exciting. Morosi's talking about starting with 1-1 counts. You know, the really outside the box ideas that change the game itself. I don't know if those are enough, if they're adopted, to save a game that's headed toward a place where labor is that kind of upset about the revenues that aren't getting shared, the money that's not coming around, this idea that, well, you're only so valuable. When the first 6 years of your value are essentially locked with some very, I mean, you take the bulk of people, players in their first 6 years, those values are essentially locked. There's only a handful that get to be Chris Bryant and make $17 million in arbitration or whatever, $20 million in arbitration. You're not going to be able to smooth this out while that process exists, while that system exists.
Are you playing this out to a strike? Where the players say, we are not going to do our jobs until we repair this 7-year indentured servitude.
I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised at all. And further, you know, if it's not fixing the 6 years, then it's fixing, at the very least, how teams are able to decide when that clock starts. I mean, playing 2 weeks of service time games with Chris Bryant or Eloy Jimenez like is going to happen at the start of the season.
Because it's how you're supposed to do it.
Because it's how you're allowed to do it, and it's the best way to do it for the organization. We're going to spend 2.5 weeks. You and I are going to spend 2.5 weeks at the beginning of the baseball season looking at Eloy swinging around in AAA going, well, now's the time. I mean, I'll give you the date. I mean, once spring training comes around, I'll give you the date he's coming up. That's just the way we know it's going to happen, and players in the union aren't thrilled with that anymore.
He's Connor McKnight. I'm Dan Bernstein. We continue to watch the news regarding the Bears defensive coordinator search. with every moment that goes by that Ed Donatell is not promoted, you wonder what is standing in the way of them promoting him and what message they're sending internally if they start looking at more people on the outside. So we'll follow that as we get more information. And when we come back, we have your first of three chances to win $1,000 in cash on this Friday. We're coming up on the Midday Midway at the top of the hour. That's going to be followed by some Bulls talk around 11:40 with Mark Schanowski, Patrick Manley with Bears and football stuff at noon. We got some games on the score this weekend, Saturday, Colts and Chiefs at 3, Cowboys and Rams at 7:15, then Sunday, Chargers and Patriots, an early start at 11:30, Eagles and Saints at 3:40. Some football observers believe it's the best weekend to be a viewer.
Well, that reminds me, too. One of these games holds a referendum for 8 teams in this league. And they haven't played in a little while. We haven't seen them on the field all that recently. But one of these teams holds a referendum on decisions that every team, all those 8 teams have made over the last couple of weeks. I'll tell you which game it is and who might be in a little bit of trouble. That's next. Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
It is time for your chance to win $1,000 in cash on The Score. This hour's keyword is over. It's over. Text over to 72881 by the end of the hour. Again, the keyword is over to 72881. One randomly selected nationwide entrant from this hour will win. Please don't text and drive. Message and data rates may apply. This song, I believe, is Decemberists,
yes,
Down by
is.
The Water. And I got into an argument.
It's a good tune.
I forgot there was a guy at a remote years ago, and I mentioned this song. It's a really good tune. And I mentioned the jangly guitar is, it sounds like Peter Buck. And it turns out it is Peter Buck.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Who's actually playing guitar, and then somebody they're like, you're wrong. It's not true. That's the December. I said, yes, it is. He guessed it
the
on
band's
that
name.
Song. Yeah, the band is the Decemberists, but he sat in and gave them some guitar tracks. So it's all good, but somebody got very, very
it's
angry.
It's a nuanced point you're trying to make there, Dan. I could see how people might miss it. I know that one of the games that you're least excited about is the Colts and Chiefs this weekend because of your irrational sports hatred for the Colts.
It's not hatred.
No, no, no.
Stop using that word.
Okay, your irrational dislike, your irrational reaction to the Colts uniform. But I think there's a place for irrational sports hatred. To be, I mean, I couldn't stand Richie Sexson for the better part of a decade, and I can't explain to you why. So if you're going to hate the Colts, that's fine. I got no problem with that. But the game that feels like a little bit of a referendum to me is the Cowboys and the Rams. And I'll tell you why. I don't trust the Cowboys. I don't.
Trust their defense?
I love their defense.
Trust Leighton Vander Esch?
I love their defense. I love that defense. That offensive line is not the offensive line of a couple of years ago. Dak Prescott, I don't think is all that good. I know he's made some throws, but the next time he throws one through the corner of the end zone with zero accuracy whatsoever will just be the 75th time he's done that this year. Like, that's Dak. That's what you're getting here. The Rams, though, I think they're going to win this game. I don't think it's going to be that much of an issue. What happens if they lose? What happens if Sean McVay fails to get out of the first round of the playoffs for a second straight year? What happens if Sean McVay,
the whole model,
the paragon of head coach in the NFL, the guy after whom everyone is chasing, the organization, the offense, the quarterback-coach relationship, the brain, right? That thing that 8 teams just spent the better part of a week and a half trying to find and then hired, with the exception of the Broncos, because they hired Vic Fangio and he didn't give a damn. What happens if they don't get out of the playoffs?
I think the idea of Sean McVay is bigger than the actual Sean McVay, if that makes sense. I think it would take some time to unwind that trade a little bit, because once the league is already well down this in this idea of, yeah, this is the kind of guy we need, this is the young, energetic, celebrated, forward-thinking white guy we need, that I don't know if him... It would have to be that offense absolutely collapsing in on itself and getting pantsed and exposed, which I don't think is possible even by this defense.
If you're going to tell me that the Rams lose because Todd Gurley isn't 100% healthy and they can't get the run game going, which kills the play action stuff that Goff is good at doing, it had gotten back on track, okay, I'm willing to listen to that. I think that probably pushes aside any kind of referendum on six head coaching hires, four of whom just, you know, sniffed once the hair pomade that Sean McVay uses. Like that, okay, I get that. But if that's a full functioning Death Star, you know, if that's an operational thing, you have to win.
And you can't say, well, Cooper Kupp is out and that doomed everything, because then what's
the
point?
You don't get to do that.
You're not allowed.
You don't get to do that because you've also got a Rams defense, which is good enough with Ndamukong Suh and Aaron Donald going against an offensive line that I'm sorry. That's not your super. It's not your offensive line of 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
They were the gold standard a couple of years ago.
It's just not the same thing. It just isn't. So I don't know. I think there's a lot. I think the Rams win. I think they win just fine because I don't really trust the Cowboys much. But it's not. I don't have this ringing endorsement of the Los Angeles Rams right now. And further, if that kick goes in, if that stupid kick goes in, and the Bears are heading out to L.A. for a second matchup.
This was the day they would be leaving right now, too. The plane probably would have left already, but instead they're watching Cody Parkey being declared a wonderful human being just for not being an a-hole.
Are we instead in an alternate world, in like Universe 42, are we talking maybe more about what the point spread is in L.A. and how the Bears might be favored on the road in the playoffs, given the thrashing that they gave the Rams?
Can we go to Universe 42 and meet that Peter Parker?
I would love to go to 42. Yeah. Yes, I like the slightly overweight Jake Johnson Peter Parker thing. I'm a big fan.
I'd like to respond to this texter, too, who apparently is texting not only from the 815, but from 17 years ago regarding the baseball right. conversation. Metric nerds ruining game. Metrics can't measure heart and being clutch. What has Billy Bean won?
Executive of the Year a number of times.
Right, but here's the other thing and what needs to be understood. Every single team, has a front office that is made up of highly educated executives with multiple graduate degrees, many of whom are Ivy League and or similarly educated. Amherst has filled up front offices. Every single team has proprietary computer analytic information. So the answer is, when has one of these nerds won the World Series? They win it every year.
Just about. I feel like that was probably why you asked me where Rick Hahn's 3 degrees were from.
Yeah, I looked it up. Rick Hahn, the guy running the White Sox.
Yeah, he's got the triple, doesn't he?
He has the BA from Michigan. He has a business degree from Northwestern Kellogg and a law degree from Harvard. He is the most educated sports executive of all time.
It's got to be up there, right? Has to be up there.
If he's not the most educated, best educated sports executive of all time, you're going to have to show me something pretty special.
But Rick would probably, if you asked Rick if he's the most educated executive in the history of sports, he'd probably say, well,
I am.
You know, maybe there's somebody else. I mean, there's probably somebody.
You're going to have to show me something pretty damn special to top that.
I don't know how you do it. I mean, it's Michigan and Harvard and Kellogg.
But every year, whatever baseball team wins the World Series, whoever is running that team is what you would describe 15 years ago as a nerd. It's not some Jim Hendry-style, bourbon-swilling, red-faced, pear-shaped old baseball man.
With a slight adjustment, 29 teams have those things and have had for a long time. The Orioles just got theirs. And they're getting
That's
their computers
I mean.
Plugged in.
By the time the Orioles have made their
they're
purchase,
they're plugging
in the
data servers and all that stuff.
Yes. So that's if you want a text from 17, 18 years ago, you can do that. But you gotta let that go. And I'll also say, with a couple of exceptions, with the Bulls being one of them, the same is true with your basketball teams. The difference is basketball. And the advance of understanding and the enlightenment of what creates winning basketball has actually created a more entertaining product.
Because they have a three-point line.
Rather than
they can score more points.
They can choose to score more points. Where baseball, all baseball has is the multi-run homer and launch angle and the opportunity over time.
I think that's a big problem.
They can't just shoot that. That's the equivalent, though, really?
I agree.
That's what you're saying.
I agree.
That is baseball shooting threes.
Mm-hmm.
shooting four. The only threes they have are two walks and a home run when they get the chance.
Listen to our guy, Jeff Sullivan, who we talk to every week the past baseball season. And there's this idea kind of bubbling around that an issue baseball has with, you know, it's a boring game and it's so slow and all this stuff. Well, you only score one run at a time. And even the three-run shot takes so long to set up that it doesn't have the same type of, I don't know, like psychological reward as popping threes from the corner every single time down the floor does. It doesn't quite work out that way in terms of, you know, fan reward time. That the analytics in basketball have shifted the game to a point where you get a 300-point night from the – well, that not playing defense.
That was so, how, but you know
that
what, though?
Just abandoning defense. Well,
yes and
not
no.
Being
the,
able to play
the
defense.
The Spurs are a bad example. And
well, yeah, but if you take
examples.
The yeah, I don't
because,
mean
because the Spurs shoot a ton of two pointers and they're making a ton of two pointers. The Spurs are actually taking advantage of the fact that so many teams just aren't used to defending you trying for 2-point shots.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me they were a bad example of a Spurs team because they're not playing defense.
No, they're just a bad example of sort of modern thinking because they've been shooting fewer threes. Mm-hmm. Houston is the team that's shooting all the, you know, getting the corner threes and shooting the corner threes and having James Harden, who's breaking everything.
That was the first 300-point game in the NBA since 2006 last night.
Wow.
Yeah.
We've got the Midday Midway coming up. I've got, I didn't know where to go with this, but there is a new crime in Scotland that I will explain to you. And it's a violation of law of some kind.
They've made something that was previously legal illegal?
As far as I know, there is...
Or this is like a really old law on the books?
No, they're
prima nocta?
They are concerned about sheep worrying.
Okay.
There is a concern about a spate of incidents of sheep worrying. I will explain what that is. We have... The actual Flat Earth Society is having a get together.
Perfect.
That's strange. And because the cast list has been announced for Avengers Endgame, there are some people examining possibilities based on the names of some characters of where the plot could be headed.
You, sir, have my attention. The Midday Midway is next. It's Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.